Today is May 22nd, 2009. This is Conduit. The panel is culture building.
All right, we're going to start. This is the panel on culture building, world building, culture building. I get to be the moderator. My name is John Brown. And I thought what we could do is start off by just introducing ourselves very quickly, and then I wanted to frame our conversation, give it a very soft frame, but give it a frame nevertheless, and then get into some questions. So let's start down here with Brandon.
Yeah.
Just go ahead and introduce yourself for folks who might not know you.
I'm Brandon Sanderson. I write fantasy books. I write not quite as many as Dave or Lee, but more than me. So there we go.
Hi, everybody. I'm Elizabeth Waters. I'm working on a sequel to my fantasy novel, Changing Fate, currently, but I have to get back to it because I just sent out the contracts on the latest Sword and Sorceress, which is 24. I have 22 and 23 here, which will be published in November. I worked for Marion Zimmer Bradley for about 2 decades, so I can tell you what happens when you don't keep your culture consistent.
Great.
Okay. I'm Dave Farland / Dave Wolverton. I've got about 50 novels that I've written and published, both for young adults, and middle grade readers. And so I do a lot of different things, both in science fiction and fantasy. And I've got a historical coming out this year and working on some thrillers, so just all different kinds of things.
John Brown, I feel like a small fry sitting between these two guys. But I got a 3-book contract with Tor for an epic fantasy series. The first is coming out in October. It's about a world where humans are being ranched by beings with immense power. It's called Servant of a Dark God.
I'm Lee Modisett, and I've written a few books along the way. The next one coming out in 2 weeks is a science fiction future thriller, psychological, et cetera, which is, I think it's fair to say, unlike anything I've ever done before. Mm-hmm. My editor says it's unlike anything anybody else has ever done before either. Uh-huh. And then for those of you who like the Imager book, the sequel, Imager's Challenge, will be out in October.
And I'm Roger White, and I've been writing science fiction and fantasy since the 80s. Basically, my science fiction got started when I was working at Novell, and I was writing manuals about products that didn't exist yet. And I said, well, okay, that's real science fiction. Let's do some real fantasy science fiction. And I got my start on that, and I published my stuff on my site on White World. I'm Roger White, My World.
Great. All right. Well, what I wanted to do then is just start off by talking, and just to frame this, a little bit about what we're talking about when we talk about culture. And what I wanted to do is just offer up a definition that we could work with up here, and then see if any of the panelists have anything they want to add to that, or maybe challenge it.
I disagree.
All right. And then I'll get into some other questions that I think would be interesting and important. So I just want to define culture here as a set of shared characteristics or traits of a community. That might include goals and values. It might include attitudes or purposes or practices. Is anybody on the panel want to add anything to that? Or
I can add something.
Change that? Go ahead.
I actually, when I do my world-building documents, one of the headings is culture, and to me, that's everything that if you took humans or the sentient beings away, would be removed from the world building. And that's separate from, you know, for me, the magic system, which exists independent of them, the geography, the weather, all of this stuff. There's the physical world building and the cultural world building, and culture to me is all that stuff that humans change.
Okay.
Or sentient beings.
I'd like to disagree and amend. I would call culture the artifacts of the values that John's talking about. The values are basically ideals. Culture is what you do with those values, whether it's opera, build temples, roads, have human sacrifices, celebrate theater, song,
or whatever. Isn't your farming techniques part of your culture?
Yeah, but they're the artifacts of those values. Mm-hmm. If you don't have an agrarian society, you aren't going to have any farming, or not much. You're not going to have a society anyway, but...
I think very often it becomes a chicken and the egg kind of thing, too, though. I kind of define culture as the software that runs your society, you know? And by that I mean...
You're getting into trouble. Your software has got to have hardware to go with it. You can't separate that.
Yeah.
You've got farming values, but you got to have plows.
Yes. Yeah. You've got to have that. But I think that, you know, cultures are so malleable. I have a friend who says, you know, if you look at humans genetically, you know, it's pretty much obvious that we're all from the same species. If you look at us culturally, there obviously we're not. Okay. In other words, our value systems and everything change so much from one society to the next, with even with roughly the same hardware, you know, as far as the tool building techniques and stuff like that, that the way that we act and react and our ideals and beliefs and everything are so varied from one culture to another that it's almost like we're not the same animal at all. And so I think of it sort of like software trying to run a society. And say, okay, this is what we have to work with. You know, we have to get some farming done, or maybe we don't have to get farming done in our society. But we have a certain set of shared belief systems in the way that we act and react because of what we're doing. Anyway,
okay. Anybody want to add anything to that before I move on to the question?
Yeah.
Let's go, with Elizabeth, and then Ron. Go ahead, Elizabeth, and then Ron.
What he was saying about software and hardware, and what Brandon was saying about the world and then the culture. I think that the point is that they're interdependent. Your physical world is going to have an impact on your culture.
Well, yes, but if there weren't any humans or sentient beings, there will be no culture.
Yeah.
I mean, when you add them, they will be influenced by the setting, but they will be the ones that create the culture. The setting will not create it. Humans reacting to the setting will create it.
Okay. Roger?
Yeah. When I assemble a story... fantasy or science fiction, the first step is to take a concept and say, what difference does it make? What difference does it make in how people are going to react? And so, in a way, I've traveled a lot, and one thing I have noticed is that there are very many logical systems that people live by. But each one is logical. I'll give you my favorite example on this. I went to Korea, and I would travel to the different resorts in Korea, and I'd get thirsty, and I'd go for a can of Coke. And in the Korean countryside, the Cokes in the rack are upside down. Now, in America, when you go to get a Coke, the Coke is right side up. Why? Now, if you're a tourist, you look at that, and the tourist says, oh, look at those Koreans. They store their Coke cans upside down. How strange. I spent enough time over there teaching that I found out that the reason is it's dusty. And because it's dusty, if you store it upside down when you decide to go drink it, why, your top will be clean. Okay. Very logical reason. Very logical. It was mysterious when you first see it, but very logical after the fact. That is the kind of thing that I try to put into my cultures.
Okay. All right. Okay, so before we get into the writerly techniques, I thought it would be interesting to actually put this, actually understand how important really is this, right? There are some things that you can do with writing that are incredibly important when you're developing your story, and other things that really aren't that important. So what I want to ask the panelists is, as a reader, when you go to a story, how important is culture to you? Do you come out of there and say, oh, such great culture, I love that book, or was it something else? I mean, as far as it plays a role, as you think as a reader, How big of a role does that play? Lee, let's start with you.
I'm not a good person to start with, but I'm going to start anyway.
Good man.
I think it's fair to say I probably put more culture into my books than most writers do. It's also fair to say that the highest I've ever gotten on a bestseller list is something like number 30, on the, not on the genre, but on the New York Times, all those. I think the two are related. Basically speaking, the simpler the book, frankly, generally speaking, and there are many exceptions, but generally speaking, the less well it sells. Because culture happens to be something which is complicated. You get beyond the superficial trappings of it, and it's complex. If you deal with that complexity, you lose a certain percentage of readers. Now, I happen to, answering John's question after many sentences, I happen to like books that have culture in them. But I've been exposed enough to know that, very frankly, the majority of readers don't. The majority of readers want sex, romance, action, almost anything but culture, or shall we say the thin veneer of culture. So as a writer, it's a very narrow tightrope that you're going to be walking. You put in too much culture, and I can guarantee that a large percentage of your readers are going to say, boy, that was slow. Some of them are going to use that word, the B word, boring. It can be a real challenge to incorporate any significant amount of culture without losing a significant amount of readership.
Okay, all right. Anybody else on the panel want to talk and address this question? Brandon, go ahead.
I will offer a contrasting view, because I think that there is a large audience out there who likes that. Sometimes they have trouble finding their way to the right books. Historical readers read big historical books and buy a lot of them, and they want lots of culture. And now they have trouble transitioning over to fantasy sometimes, because the reason they want lots of culture is that they want to learn something as they're reading. But the biggest historical books are extremely more immersive in culture, and do sell very well.
Hold it.
Yeah.
We're talking apples and oranges here. I will agree with you if you're going to bring in, shall we say, historical or romance. But if you're talking science fiction and fantasy, you do have a problem.
Well, you know, Wheel of Time is very immersive culturally. Now, some may disagree with that, but I find it one of the most culturally immersive book series, and relatively small on action and romance, and very high on culture. Why have people latched onto that as opposed to other ones? It's hard to say why some things become a phenomenon and others don't. But I do think that fantasy readers read because of the learning curve. This is why we read the genre. We want to be thrown into something that's immersive. Now, it can go over our heads, but at the same time, I mean, someone else who's been doing very well is Stephen Erickson. He's extremely immersive. In fact, he's one of the ones many people call boring. But there's a huge amount of culture, and he sells very well. And so it can happen. And I think you're selling yourself short. I mean, you outsell Stephen Erickson. I've seen the numbers. So you're saying people don't want to read this. Well, I think that what you're pointing to is saying fantasy has trouble getting on the bestseller list alone simply because of our small readership, is what I would say.
I don't think we're disagreeing, but I think we're talking different magnitudes in a sense. I'll admit, I have a large, loyal, devoted readership for which I am very, very grateful. But that readership pales in comparison to, shall we say, the readership of, say, Harry Potter or what have you.
Well, romance outsells us by huge orders of magnitude, but none of us are here to write that. We're here to write science fiction and fantasy. I think within science fiction and fantasy, a large amount of culture is appropriate and desired because the people who are choosing to read our genre instead of those other genres are looking for that that immersive, that you're stepping into a completely new world, and it's still a balancing act to do. But I think the people who do it very well sell very well for fantasy, and that we shouldn't scare people who wanting to write fantasy and science fiction off from putting a lot of culture in.
Dave, did you have something?
I just want to say, just point out, you look at the best selling science fiction book probably of all time is Dune, and the best selling fantasy of all time is probably Lord of the Rings, although yeah. Harry Potter numbers actually beat them out.
Yeah.
But both of those books, when I was young, I looked at them and I said, man, the world creation in here was a big thing for me. And so I really enjoyed immersive books that took me out of my world and put me into a new world, and building this culture is part of that. So I think, though, that it's different for different readers. I have to agree with Lee that overall, the more accessible your book is, the more people are going to read it, and very often, they are looking for something other than a deep, immersive experience in another world. So I think that there's huge audiences either way. I think it can be done both ways, but it's still a difficult trick to pull off.
I want to add one comment there based on what both Dave and Brandon have said. We're overlooking one thing, which we, Dave, certainly, and I think Brandon is beginning to exploit as well. The one nice thing about culture and putting it in your books is you have a tendency to keep your readers.
You do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. The books which are shiny and shallow often will sell for an author a lot of books initially. There are very few of those authors who survive.
Yep, absolutely right.
I'd just like to add something about this. I know, and this is just, and I think they've talked about a range of personal tastes, but I know that I love fantasy because I'm going to something new. And that it's a new world and new people. It's like travel narratives. I love Huckleberry Finn for this same reason, and Mark Twain put a lot of culture in that. But I do think that there are ways to make that culture impenetrable and very difficult to get through in the beginning and boring. And I think there are ways to slip it in that makes it very, very interesting and almost effortless, and suddenly you are in a very strange world, but it's more effortless. And so I would like to transition now, and Elizabeth, maybe we'll start with you. And the question that I'd like to pose now are there any concepts or practices that you have found extremely helpful as you're trying to develop a culture to help you do that as you're working on a story? Any concepts or practices that you have had a lot of bang for the buck to help you develop your culture?
Well, my mother was a history teacher, so I used to get history as bedtime stories. I think, basically, in my case, a lot of work occurs in my subconscious. And the trick is then to either take good enough notes or have a first reader I trust to make sure that the moon isn't dark one night and full the next. How many people have you here ever read Bimbos of the Death Sun? Oh, you really should. It takes place at a science fiction convention. It's a sort of spoof of science fiction conventions. And the guest of honor, this author who has written this interminable series about this barbarian hero, really totally hates the series by now. But he's got devoted fans who love it, and there are like whole articles written in fanzines about why this guy's mother has blue eyes in one book and brown eyes in another. And as Sharon McCrum says in commenting on this, the obvious explanation, indifference and Shivas Regal, never occurred to anybody. So, to keep your culture consistent, you do have to work at it.
So you use it, so you've got a reader to help make sure that yours is consistent. For the rest.
Mostly, I take notes.
I should point out that in Bimbos of the Deaf Thumb, there's a young author who's running around the convention trying to sell his wonderful tome called The Rune Lords. which is why I have the book, and I haven't read it yet, but it was given to me by somebody who said that. By an alert fan. Yes.
So, okay, so the rest of you authors, what are some concepts or some practices, some things that you use that you found have been very helpful in developing these cultures?
Well, first of all, a lot of our conflicts that we have, you know, very often tend to be cultural in nature. You know, we have differing ways of viewing the world and acting toward the world, in part because of different belief systems. And so, you know, for example, when I was over in China, we were looking at making a Rune Lords movie over there, and I was talking, I was talking to a producer about, you know, how much is it going to cost us for insurance for, the people that we have on the castle walls. What if a guy falls off of a castle wall during a combat scene and gets killed? And he said, oh, no problem, you know. If he died, you only have to pay him 50 cents per day. You know, if he lived, you pay $1. He says, you get a whole other worker for only 50 cents. You know, and it was like, you know, their view of the value of mankind was pretty limited, to put it that way, to suggest. But, you know, quite frankly, people are just excess. There are so many of them that the more that we can get rid of, the better. And you know, as a filmmaker and as a human being, I was just sort of, you know, agape at this. You know, I was horrified by the thought that these guys don't have any health insurance, they don't have any life insurance, it's talking about, well, what if we get sued? You know, oh, there's a limit, you know, the value of a human life is $10,000 in China, and they cannot sue you for anything more than $10,000. So, you know, that's the worst that I have to look forward to. So a lot of our arguments had to do with the value of human life and this kind of thing. You know, as we got into it, they were so grateful to me because I didn't bring up, you know, the problems in Tibet, you know, and so-called human rights. And I was like, I was trying to be a good visitor, and so I didn't bring up the whole human rights issue, but. Boy, I was really burning behind the ears as I was being praised for not bringing up human rights, you know. So I like to look at my cultural conflicts as a good potential source of conflict in the novel. If nothing else, to start off. My story isn't about the culture, it's about people who are living in their cultures and acting and reacting against each other like they were pool balls bouncing off of one another.
Okay. Anybody else? Maybe we should start with that. Do you actually do the culture before you start drafting, or is it something that happens while or after? I mean, what? It sounds like for you, you were doing a lot of this development before, and then you start looking at the conflict.
I do it before, but very often as I start thinking about the ramifications of things, the culture builds as you're writing. You know, that's kind of
the answer to your question is
yes. Yes. before, during, and after. Yes.
Yeah. In my first novel, for example, Changing Fate, the heroine and her brother escape from the siege of their castle and are free. And then they wind up in a culture where they have a year king who is sacrificed every year. And, of course, her brother gets chosen to be the year king. And there are no villains in this book. They're just people who hold different views of what is right.
Okay.
So the culture really does create the conflict, but my focus is more on the characters.
Okay.
Your original question was, how do you keep it consistent? And then the second question is, when do you do it? I, at the recommendation of Howard Taylor, I started using a wiki software, personal wiki software, found it very, very useful for keeping things consistent. It's called WikiDPad. I've started using it, and the concept that you can just link all words together, creating a Bible. You've got to have some sort of Bible, otherwise you're going to have inconsistencies. And if inconsistencies don't bother you, then that's fine. But the best authors, the ones who do this, run into all kinds of problems with this. Even those who are very good at remembering these things. Robert Jordan, I now know, had two full-time assistants who main jobs were continuity. And so he's paying full time two people to be reading through the books and keeping track of all the continuity problems and getting, pulling, you know, going back and saying, get me these this list of names and this sort of stuff. That's how he did it, with full time assistants. I'm trying to do it with this software. In the past, I've simply used a Word file that I did all of my world building beforehand, and then I changed things as I was writing it along, and then afterward, if I was going to write a sequel, I would go back through the Word file and change everything to match the book, or take a list of notes of things I need to change in the books to match the Word file, and that became the Bible. That seems to get unwieldy once you get past the three book series I've written. I don't know. Ask Lee, because he's got a 30 book series.
No, it's only a 16 book series.
Only 16? That's it for records?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see. Yeah. The 16th book will be out next January. Well, I have a 16 book series, and I have a 7 book series, and actually, I do it the old fashioned way. I have a set of notes. I have all of them on computer, and a lot of it's in my head, and I don't have any personal assistants, and the first person who sees a book that I finish is my editor. I don't have any first readers or second readers or third readers. So far, I haven't made any huge blunders. My readers do catch them, however, and there is one. There is the mention of a non-existent culture in the first 10 pages of The Magic of Records. After 16 years, somebody found it. And so I turned it into a joke in books 16 and 17. You may have to look for it, but it's there. I guess I just do it in that sense. Like Brandon and like Dave, I do my world building, maps, and all of that in advance. I tend to think, however, as the culture as a character, because cultures shape people. People just don't rattle around in them. Cultures exert pressures on people. Cultures press people to do things that they wouldn't normally do. All you have to do is look at Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, etc. Any number of cultures. People who are, you would think, would otherwise be normally decent people get pressed into doing things that they would not really want to do. Cultures have tremendous power to influence large segments of their population. And if you don't think so, you aren't living in the real world. Every culture does exert those pressures. And that's something that I think you need to build into a book. Because one of the conflicts any character should have is with what they want to do and what the culture wants them to do.
So, you know, that's one of the questions I was actually going to ask. Because as I was thinking about this, I thought, culture is, you know, when we talk about this, it is a characteristic. It's a set of shared traits. It's like a character. And so I actually want, and Roger, we'll start with you on this one. I'll reflect my question on you, Roger. And that is, are there any concepts, in addition to what Lee has been talking about, that we think about when we think about characters that might be useful when we start thinking about culture and developing the culture? You have anything that might...
I haven't talked much because I usually attack this problem from a very different angle.
Okay.
When I start, first of all, I don't write long series of stories. And so the question of how to keep the consistency is minimal for my writing. I write short stories. And the heart of any of my stories is thinking of a new... usually a new technology, a new innovation, and what difference is this going to make to the people who experience it? And that's the heart of what I'm writing about. Characterization fits on top of that. Basically, what I'm doing is saying, here's a neat concept. Now, to give you an example of that, One series that I have written about is what I call the HX aliens. And in that, I wanted a different style of alien. And I thought about it a lot. And what I finally came up with was, let's make this alien really big. Really big. And the humans are mosquitoes. They come to this alien, and just like a mosquito comes to a human, why does a mosquito come to a human? Mosquito comes, well, that one didn't live. But they come because if they and get away, it's usually valuable. They have like 10 times as many eggs. It's a real risk-reward situation. So what I did was said, okay, this is an alien that humans don't understand, but it's really quite rewarding if they can get to that alien and get away. That was the heart of the story. From there, the culture developed. What kind of a culture is going to grow out of going into a risky situation and coming out either dead or a big winner? And watching that trickle through the rest of society. That's how I work.
Well, I think that's answering the question that I asked earlier that I couldn't get quite any answers to. How do you go about doing it? So the rest of you, either about the character or about how you go about developing culture. Because mine is kind of like that. I get a concept and then I start asking what are ramifications. And sometimes I get it up front. My book that I just released is releasing out. I got one thing that was absolutely brilliant at the end, you know, and that fed into it. So, okay.
To some degree, you start out with how is this world different from ours, for example. In The Rune Lords, I basically have a lot of mega fauna going on. I have giant reavers. I have frouth giants. I have these giant boars in the Dunwood. And in fact, everything seems to be large. And when I was writing the book, I thought, you know, what if this world was sort of like, our world was 20,000 years ago, where we had 14 different breeds of mammoth living here in the United States. And we had giant sloths and cave bears and stuff like that. And then the question becomes, how would that affect my people? Well, my people, I decided, would probably be... have a stronger flight or fight response than what we do. Okay, so to that degree, I realized immediately my characters are not human. Okay, they have this little genetic difference, and so there's an awful lot of people where they're confronted with some big problem. You know, and they've got these pounding hearts and whatnot. You know, and when they go into battle. You know, they charge in and throw everything they are into that battle. So, you know, to some degree, I start looking as you say, the hardware of your world, and what ramifications does that then have on the types of cultures that you're going to be creating.
Interesting. Does anybody have anything else they want to add to that?
Well, I don't know. It might spin us off into a different topic. I'm sure a lot of us have worked with a lot of aspiring new authors, and generally, my experience has been that they don't lack for ideas. That reading a lot of science fiction fantasy, wanting to write it, those two desires mixing together means people are generally coming up with interesting cultures, coming up with interesting ideas. The trick is getting that into a book in a way that's either not boring or that doesn't leave too many unanswered questions, so that when important elements come up that they feel foreshadowed. I mean, so you want it to feel real, but not boring. And that's hard. And I think that's much harder than coming up with the ideas and keeping track of them. So I wouldn't mind talking about having a question thrown out at the panel, because I'd be curious to know how they do that, because it's perhaps the biggest trick in writing science fiction and fantasy as opposed to another genre. I mean, there are things that are harder to do. I think that you need to learn to create sympathetic, interesting characters and use viewpoint and all these things. That's more fundamental than this. But if you're looking specifically at science fiction and fantasy, the big thing you have to learn is learning curve. And what do you do? And how do you get all this information across? And I guess since I raised the question, I can just attack it myself, and then and others can look at it. But this has been something I've thought about a lot. My answer has been to be very careful in the first three chapters, taking a less is more approach to the first three chapters, mixed with a determining what is important for the conflict, which cultural elements are going to be plot related, and which ones are going to be more window dressing, and making sure that I'm hitting the plot related ones and then adding in the window dressing ones. And prioritizing. If I'm writing a book where we've got different characters' religions influencing why they're in conflict with each other and the world around them, I want the reader to understand the religion first. Whereas in that book, the way the different languages and linguistics work may not be as important. I mean, you still want to have touches on it, but in another book, the way languages interact may be central to the magic system or to the conflict of the characters. I hit that first, and that.
I'd like to say something on this. I think I disagree on one point that Brandon said fundamentally. There shouldn't be any window dressing. There are little things which are fundamental to the culture, but the little things ought to still feed back into the fundamental cultural differences and what have you. And one of the things that I tend to do is in those opening chapters, and I agree with Brandon's point about being very careful in the opening chapters, but you can use little things to foreshadow the larger conflicts. The terms people use, even the utensils they use when they're eating, for example, or the way they eat, or the way they attack things. And I mean attack in the sense of discussions or talks or the way they interact with people. What's the role of a serving girl? Is she a part of the family or is she a chaplain? You can come up with a tremendous number of simple interactions in the way people do, which will foreshadow exactly what that culture is all about, so that it's not a shock when something larger occurs.
I want to add two things to this, and that is, a number of years ago, I was trying to look at this, and how much information can you really pack into the beginning of a story before it starts? Because I read this wonderful story by Vonda McIntyre, but the very beginning of it was just so hard for me to get into. And so one of the ways that I did that is I went out and I started counting new names, right, names that would be difficult for me to remember. And then I took that and I said, I'm going to apply this to these fantasy stories with new, not just new names, but new terms, new concepts. And I'm going to get an idea of what I'm comfortable with. And so I got a whole bunch of books out, and I just started counting terms in the first X number of pages. It was amazingly revealing to me, okay? The books that were opaque went over a certain number, a threshold of names and terms, and I knew exactly what that was. Per page, I could say, if I keep it in the first couple of pages to around 5 to 6 new terms, I'm okay. If, at least for me. Now, somebody else might have a higher threshold, but for me, that's what I needed to do. The other thing is, and I think when we talk about bringing culture on, I think it's the same thing as bringing character on. And for me, a lot of character can be illustrated or shown by putting it into action. We don't have to have a long passage about it. We just let it happen. And I think that's one way, besides keeping the terms down and the new concepts down, and it's kind of like what Lee was just saying, is that you just bring it on in action. Just let it happen. And it takes up so much space to let something happen. Is there anybody who wants to say anything else? And then I think we'll take some questions and then close.
One comment about all the strange new names. What I try to do is make each one start with a different letter of the alphabet. That way, even if the name is, if the reader skims over it and it's unpronounceable, it's the A character, the B character, and so forth.
Scott Card has an excellent essay on naming on his website, which talks about that, and that's one of the things he suggests too, as well as varying length of names and things like that.
Syllables.
Yeah.
But also getting into different cultural roots and so forth too. Yeah.
However, don't make the names too long. If you will notice, when we deal with most people in our culture, and since this is the culture we're writing for, almost nobody has a three-syllable name. Even if they do have a three-syllable name, somehow it usually gets shortened.
Yeah.
That's why I'm Lisa instead of Elizabeth, because nobody's way to call me Elizabeth.
I have a daughter named Elizabeth, and I persist in calling her Elizabeth.
I think I'm the only one in the entire world who uses her full name.
All right. At what time is it? How much time do we have? About 5 minutes?
No, actually.
About 10? Let's see if there are any questions from the audience. And we'll take a couple of those, and then we'll wrap up. Anybody have any questions?
Sir? What's the primary concern you have when creating a cult? The primary things you focus on?
Primary things you focus on. Folks, who wants to take this one?
Depends on the book. I said it earlier, I look for sources of conflict, and I put my effort there. Now, different people have different approaches. If you want to write like Tolkien, he said everywhere and spent 20 years world-building it. I don't have 20 years to world build. And so I'm looking for what is important to this book. And then, you know, Lee brought up something very important, which is the don't waste space. You'll notice that a lot of the really good fantasy writers don't waste words. If there's a sentence you could put in there that you could replace with another sentence that gives one of these little hints about culture, and you do it, then those are the little things that are important. But if I'm in all my preparation time, I'm spending on where's the conflict.
Yeah. Anybody have any other response to that question?
To me, the culture again is the handmaiden to the technology, and it will fall out of it. If you have a farming technology, you're going to have some kind of a farming culture. If you have an industrial technology, you're going to have some kind of an industrial culture. Beyond that, think about ramifications of your technology. To give you an example of what I mean there, if you have a farming culture that's using horse and human power, leadership, as in some kind of kingship, is probably going to be a very important part of your government. If, on the other hand, you have a technology that is mostly machine-oriented, then universal education is probably going to be more important as a fallout of your culture. That's the kind of difference that you need to be looking at.
However, it also works the other way. Certain value systems will not allow the development of a culture beyond a certain point, and we've seen that historically. So, yes, the ramifications of technology will go through, but you've got to remember, somebody mentioned China. The Chinese had the blast furnace almost 1,000 years before Western Europe discovered it. They had rockets almost 1,000 years beforehand. None of those were ever used, and one of the reasons was basic economics. When you have a lot of people in a unified culture, it frankly takes a lot of money to develop technology beyond a certain point. If human life is inexpensive, the economics don't favor technology, technological development. And that's something that you have to keep in mind, because that value influences the culture and how far the technology will go.
Can I make an answer to this, and then we'll get to another question? Part of my answer is just, you know, you got to follow your passion. You have to be smart about it and think about things. But part of this is just you following your passion as well. You might be so interested in the government aspect of it that you neglect other things because that's what you're so passionate about, and that's what your story's going to end up being about. So you got to follow your passion as well.
Yeah, you know, the things that fascinate you, you know, are important. I've known authors who will, you know, in a fantasy novel, they have to stop for a page and a half to describe a woman's dress, okay? Now, as a man, you know, I'm more interested in, you know, is she clothed or unclothed, you know? That's kind of as far as I can go. But, you know, there are readers out there that, you know, are desperate to know, you know, what kind of dress is she wearing? You know, where do the materials come from? Is it beaded? Is it silk? Is it, you know?
And how can I make it into a costume?
Exactly. And they're always looking for that. And I recall reading an author a few years back who was really long-winded. I mean, he couldn't talk about a sword until he told exactly what mountain range it came from and who had forged it and under what conditions and when and how did it get its knock in it. And he'd spend a page and a half talking about swords. And my first reaction was like, oh my gosh, that I was totally absorbed in this tale. And it was just like overwrought with this world building. But, I was just really felt compelled to just sit down and say, okay, forget everything else. I want to sit down and read this book. And I think that's a great thing.
I want to make a short comment. Yeah, I think Tolkien actually exemplifies this following your passion thing that Dave talked about. He was a linguist, and the entire structure of The Lord of the Rings is based on his studies as an early European linguist. And the languages are the things that he thought were the most important, which is why there are umpteen appendices and what have you dealing all with the linguistics.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Another question. Go ahead.
Do you ever use real-world culture elements in your stories? And do you think that that's a good idea to kind of help bring readers into?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, I look at it, when you get into a fantasy world, one of the oldest devices is that you have a person who leaves our world and goes into the fantasy world, or a person from the fantasy world comes to our fantasy world. And that's to sort of bridge that that need for the reader to be able to, to become involved in our world. So I always look for some kind of character who is going to serve as that bridge, which means that I have to build at least one of the cultures. See, I usually have multiple cultures in my worlds. One of the cultures is going to have to be somewhat like, something that we're familiar with.
I'll just address this, and then we'll probably need to wrap up. But I love reading about other cultures. And if I find anything at all that I can stuff into the current project, it's going in there. And if it doesn't work, okay, I'll take it out. But I'm going to stuff it in there and see if it'll hang. And oftentimes, later, like this thing that I was just talking about, these tattoos that I had these people wearing in this book, all of a sudden I was like, oh, my freaking heck, this is why these are there, right? And it all started, though, because I was passionate, and I was interested in other cultures and other things. I think Brandon did this with his Mistborn series, right? You started with a culture based on religion, right? And then went from there and changed it.
It's a tool that you can use. Not all authors use it. Some really like to use it. It's just another tool. If you're basing on an Earth culture and you can give the right feel, Guy Gabriel Kay does this brilliantly in his books. And I never feel like I'm reading it and saying, oh, he's just ripping off. No, he's using a different paradigm and basing a story set there. And I love it when he does it, and it works very well in books. And if you can give those hints from the beginning, it can soften your learning curve. In a certain way that can be very helpful. Other authors don't do it as much. They want to be as different and distinctive as possible, but, it's been talked about a lot that the idea that human creativity is the recombination of familiar elements into surprising new things. We don't, creating something that you've never seen, a lot of people, philosophers and psychologists say it's impossible. You can only combine two things you have seen into something that, uses elements of both of those. And so that's what we tend to do.
Okay. We're going to close this up. So we're out of here. And what I'd like to do is, Roger, we'll start with you. And if there's any other panel or event or anything that you want to make sure these folks know about, go ahead and do it. And we'll just go down the line and then we'll end.
Well, I have a reading tomorrow, too. And I'll also be talking Sunday again at 1. And if you would like to read some of what I've written, why I keep a website, I'm Roger White.
That's right. World.
My world. White world. So that's where you can find what I have.
I'm on a bunch of things, but I guess I'd just give you the name of the website, which is really simple. It's www.LEModesitJr.com.
That's great. I've got a 2-hour workshop I'm doing tonight called The 3 Things You Must Learn to Write Killer Stories.
And I'll be doing a reading tomorrow in the executive boardroom at noon. I'll be doing a signing at 2 p.m. Beyond that, I have my David Farland's Daily Kick in the Pants, daily writing tips that I send out via email. If you'd like to be on my writing list, just come up and give me a piece of paper with your email address on it, and I will put you on the list.
Okay, I have signing at 2 with him, and my reading is at 4 tomorrow, and my website is www.elizabethwaters, all one word, run together, and it's Elizabeth with an S, not a Z, .com.
I've also got signing tomorrow, too, so tomorrow at 2, you better either be at our signing or in his reading.
Well, since I'm at that 2 o'clock signing, too, yeah. You're really in trouble.
Yeah, and I have looked in the dealer's room, and they do have books for sale, which is always nice to see. So you can go grab copies of our books and bring the signing. I think that's everything. I might have a reading sometime. I don't know. They haven't told me. So come to the signing at 2 and ask me.
Okay. All right. Thanks, guys. You're very, very nice.